I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of SHE, Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses business approaches to address social problems. Its first initiative is providing sanitary protection to menstruating women and girls in developing countries. Elizabeth founded Sustainable Health Enterprises in 2007 after working in Mozambique and witnessing women with inadequate sanitary products. SHE makes loans to women who distribute and will eventually manufacture pads from local materials. The pads are then sold at affordable prices. Welcome to From Scratch, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Jessica. I'm glad to be here.
I'm wondering, why has this problem of inadequate protection to menstruating women been under the radar screen in developing countries versus other public health problems that have occupied more of the public mind share?
Well, I think there are two major reasons for that. I mean, number one, menstruation is a taboo, even in the U.S. I'm sure if we went to went down to D.C., even Hillary Clinton would probably secretly put her tampon or pad in her pocket before she goes to the bathroom. So it's not just a developing country issue. It's definitely a global issue, and hopefully we're changing things as we get more and more visibility around this. The second thing is I come from an international development background, working with different actors, whether they be big multinational organizations like the World Bank or NGOs. And typically how they're set up, that work in developing countries, typically how they're set up is by thematic areas. So whether it be health or education or economic development, if you're in charge of health and you have all these different issues to tackle, quickly, HIV, for example, comes up to the top in sub-Saharan Africa. Sanitary pads, not so much. So it gets deprioritized. Now, if you talk to the education person, they want to make sure that there are teachers in the classroom. Sanitary pads then falls by the wayside again. And the same thing goes for economic development. So I completely understand why it's sort of fallen off some radars. It's on everyone's radar, but it hasn't been owned and prioritized based on the structure, I think, of international development as well.
Now, we're talking about menstruating women and girls, and if they're not using adequate protection, what are they using?
I think the majority of people use rags, and it's typically washed with water that's available, which isn't always clean, and then dried also in spaces where, now, like I said, it was taboo, so you're not going to necessarily put your menstruation rag out on the clothesline. So sometimes we've been hearing stories about people, girls and women, putting the rags to dry under a bed, let's say, and that's where you find bacteria coming together, and that can't be good for usage the next time.
When you say bacteria forms, what exactly can happen to a woman who doesn't use adequate protection?
From my conversations with OBGYNs, what it sounds like is the rag, and how they describe what is a typical rag, it's not necessarily silk-like. It's not smooth. And so when you're using a rag, it often creates friction with the skin, which might create an open sore. And that, coupled with, let's say, a rag that has been cleaned with unsanitary water, water that there's spill off, let's say, from latrines, etc., that coupled with the open sore leads to, I actually name what kind of infection, but something that we should definitely pursue and look into better.
We talk about inadequate protection in developing countries, and it wasn't until the 1920s or 30s that tampons and sanitary pads were developed even in the United States. Can you talk briefly about the history of tampons and sanitary pads in developed countries?
It was Tampax, which was part of Kimberly-Clark. Commercially, Tampax came on board in the late 20s. 1920s in the U.S. But before that, actually, in Egypt, they were people were using things like papyrus and other materials, and basically creating an absorbent tampon-like structure and inserting it when they were menstruating. So they didn't have the package that and the commercials that we see today, but essentially it was a similar application. Recently, I talked to a class, design class, and a student from the Philippines said that they were using coconut fibers in the Philippines. So I think you make do with what you have, and we are trying to bring some more resources and technical expertise and some training to things that women and girls have been trying to overcome for a long time. So I don't claim to be bragging to be the first one to try to tackle this.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of SHE, Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses market-based approaches to address social problems. One of their first initiatives is helping to provide sanitary protection to menstruating women and girls in developing countries. How did you get involved in the social policy and public health world initially? Did you have a sense after business school that you wanted to get involved in addressing social problems? What did you think you wanted to do after mm-hmm. you graduated from Harvard Business School?
I definitely wanted to follow my passion. My passion is around equality and equality of opportunity. And for me, it was very clear that the best way I saw to do that was by using business approaches. And that mentality had been, I think, been growing over time and started way back, let's say, even first graduating from college from Notre Dame and working in Austria and researching why they had such a good social policy system. Why did everyone... seemingly everyone have health care? Why did everyone have an affordable college education or access to affordable college education? And I wanted to take that and see how we can apply it to other places, whether it be the U.S. or whether it be in Africa or South America. But at the core, I think your question is really about my passion for equality, which started at such a young age, probably before I could remember. Actually, when I finished up at grad school in 2007, I was the statistic that Harvard Business School did not like. That is, I was I remember getting in my inbox the email from Career Services. So, what's your job? And tell us what your salary is going to be for the next year. And I had to hit delete because in my mind I had the best job. I didn't even consider it a job. I was doing what I was passionate about.
Were there any other career choices you were flirting with prior to getting into the public policy, public health, social service world?
Sure. When I was a senior in college, after doing a lot of math and science, I ended up doing studying economics, and I was studying German, and so the natural thing when recruiters came to campus was actually to go, if I'm going to interview with a bank, why not go interview with Deutsche Bank? So I thought if I'd pick one. So I went in and I went to the interview and I thought, I'd give this a shot. Put on my suit. I always feel like it's Halloween when I put on a business suit. But and let alone the lipstick that probably was the same lipstick I used for the prom. And I went into the interview and there were two young people, all dapper, probably right out of Harvard undergrad, and had spent a couple years in the banking industry and with their pearls, and they were across from me, and they started out, "So, Elizabeth, welcome today. We're glad to talk to you, and we're going to start out with a little case study for you." And then he kicked it off. I forget his name, but he said, "So we've got this toilet paper company, and what we're trying to do is increase the revenues of the toilet paper and the distribution around the world." And he goes on and on and gives a few stats. And he said, "So what would you do?" And I just said to him, I said, "I don't give a damn about toilet paper." And I got up and I left. I didn't want to waste his time. I didn't want to waste my time. And I think it was very valuable to understand along the way what different people do. And that really has brought me to where I am and doing what I love, being an entrepreneur. But it's kind of funny as well to think how I just didn't give a damn about toilet paper. And now I'm in sanitary pad space. Maybe I should have taken that job.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses market-based approaches to address social problems. One of their first initiatives is providing sanitary protection to menstruating women and girls in developing countries. Elizabeth noticed a link between sanitary protection and economic development. So let's take a woman in Rwanda, since this is the first country that your initiative is in. What happens to, let's say, a 15-year-old girl who starts menstruating? Can you walk me through her experience?
Sure. I don't know if any of the men have changed the channel already. I have two brothers and a father, and it's always interesting hearing how they describe what I do. I think they say healthcare most of the time. So I'm just going to put you in the shoes of that 15-year-old girl. And you're 15, you're sitting in your exam. It's the final week of school. You've gone through 6 months of learning algebra, and you finally get to show your stuff in your exam. And all of a sudden, you're writing the test, and a stream of blood runs down your leg. And you know that when you stand up to hand in that test, everyone's going to see a stain on the back of your pants. So you have a very, very real decision to make. Do you even go to school? Do I get up? Do I hand in that test? And I'm sure all of us have felt at some point in their lives the feeling of embarrassment and shame. And so if you can avoid that, I think every one of us would try to avoid that. So what happens a lot of the time is that that 15-year-old girl doesn't go to school maybe 3 or 4 days a month to avoid that sort of embarrassment. The typical rags, which is used, isn't necessarily effective all the time. And so you wouldn't want to go to school or walk around or go to work if you're a woman, because the blood would bleed through. And so you end up staying home. And when you don't have girls go to school, you don't have women go to work, your family is losing out, because for every dollar a woman earns, she invests up to 90% in the family.
My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses market-based approaches to address social problems. We'll hear more from Elizabeth coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of SHE, Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses business approaches to address social problems. Its first initiative is providing sanitary protection to menstruating women and girls in developing countries. Elizabeth founded Sustainable Health Enterprises in 2007 after working in Mozambique and witnessing women with inadequate sanitary products. She makes loans to women who distribute and will eventually manufacture pads from local materials. The pads are then sold at affordable prices. Why are pads and sanitary protection so expensive in these developing mm-hmm. countries?
There are three main drivers of the price of sanitary pads mm-hmm. in many different countries. And one is taxes. Actually, there's an 18% sales tax on pads in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other countries that have such sales tax. The second is raw materials. So all the raw materials that are that make up pads are imported, typically from Europe, from France and Italy. And then the third, and actually the biggest price driver, is actually distribution costs. When pads get to, for example, the capital city in Rwanda, in Kigali, they then go through 2 to 3 middle people to get to the end consumer. So that's actually 30% of the price. And let's say it's $1.10 for a pack of 10. So what we're doing right now is we've helped jumpstart 50 sole proprietor distribution businesses. So women going out selling the existing product as we continue with our own product development at 15% less than they were before, because we're cutting out all these middle people.
Had the larger corporations tried to supply their products for lower cost in these countries?
Well, some of the larger companies have done a great job at providing some of the products for free. But unfortunately, it's not sustainable. So if you go in and you donate to a handful of schools, let's say 15 schools, sanitary supplies for about 500 girls, well, after 3 years, the companies tend to pull out. You can't stay around forever. And then you have 500 girls that are used to using internationally branded products, and now they're left with nothing. So we're looking – that's exactly why we're doing what we're doing right now, which is hopefully a more long-lasting effect, which is helping jumpstart local businesses.
So what exactly are you doing with the local women, let's say, in Rwanda to help provide the sanitary protection logistically?
A few things. Number one, we're providing health and hygiene education. There is a great thirst for knowledge about girls' and women's own bodies. So when we had talked to the hundreds of girls and women in 2008, there were so many questions around, why do I menstruate? Is this normal? And so we felt that we had to provide equal access to this great information around people's bodies and what is normal and what they can do about it. So that's the one thing. The second thing is we're training women. We've actually trained 50 community healthcare workers in simple business skills. So that's inventory management, that's simple bookkeeping. And they actually are now all over Rwanda. They are doing health and hygiene education for their community members. We've had over 5,000 people newly trained in health and hygiene education all over Rwanda. And also they are selling sanitary pads, the African kind of generic pad, for lack of a better name, at 15% less than they were before, because, as I said before, distribution costs are a huge driver in the price of pads. And this is really priming the pump for us to help them start their own manufacturing of pads down the line. We're using local raw materials. And so right now we're actually working with farmers in sourcing those. What we're using right now is banana fibers, and we've actually come up with a process with no chemicals to make banana fibers, which is typically a waste material not used by the farmers typically. And we've made that just as absorbent as that African generic benchmark product. So the goal is to have women extracting the fibers with the farmers, manufacturing their own, and then they already have this great distribution network to sell their own product.
You refer to sustainable health enterprises as we. We are training these women in Rwanda. We're working with the farmers to manufacture banana fibers to produce these products. How big is sustainable health enterprises?
Well, Jessica, it's funny. I say we. I think I've been – that's a habit that goes way back when I was the unemployed Harvard Business School grad pounding the pavement and going to talk to the heads of these huge organizations and saying, you know, we at Sustainable Health Enterprises are looking into this. And I think every entrepreneur can relate to that, and to not only being starting up as one person, but also feeling, I think I say we because I've never viewed myself or Sustainable Health Enterprises as one person. We've grown to thousands of people that are supporting us in different ways, whether it be the 70-year-old chemical engineer professor at a leading university in the United States who's working with us on banana fibers, to a wonderful college student at the Kigali Institute of Technology who's going out in the field, and she is from Rwanda, talking to the community healthcare workers and trying to understand what they need out of a product. So we started out, I guess, as one, me, as Sustainable Health Enterprises, but with a busloads of people with me.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of SHE, Sustainable Health Enterprises. One of their first initiatives is helping to provide sanitary protection to menstruating women and girls in developing countries. You witnessed firsthand women with inadequate sanitary products while you were working in Mozambique. This is before you started Sustainable Health Enterprises. What's the specific experience that you had where you found out about inadequate sanitary products?
I initially found out about this issue when I was working for a large organization in Mozambique. And actually, my boss, so to speak, went to a meeting in D.C. And when he left, I took the opportunity to go around and actually get out in the field and talk to the entrepreneurs that we were supporting. And one of the entrepreneurs was a woman that ran a bag factory. And I did what I was trained to do and talked to her about her business and how efficient it was and how many workers she had coming in and what the absence rate was. And actually, of the 25 workers, she said four are typically absent a day or five, one or two because of a family commitment, the other three or four because they're menstruating. And that's actually when I found out that pads were too expensive typically, and rags weren't always effective.
Why start in Rwanda? I mean, this obviously is a problem that's rampant. Why Rwanda mm-hmm. specifically?
A few reasons. The first is that we had heard that there was evidence that this problem existed, and that was confirmed by talking to hundreds there. The second was there are already fantastic networks of people. And so we did not want to build a wheel. And there's a fantastic network, women's networks, church networks, this fabric that is epitomizes what a good distribution network is, low transaction costs, quick exchange of products or services, but that just hasn't been tapped into as a business engine. And so that's the second reason. The third reason was that there was some evidence that there's a willingness to pay. So, like I said before, this is not taking the typical charity donation-only approach. We are really helping jumpstart businesses that local people can own so that they can drive their own economic, health, educational growth. And so that's why we're in Rwanda.
How often are you in Rwanda versus in your apartment in New York City?
I spend as little time in my apartment as I can. and about a month every quarter I spend in Rwanda. I just got back, actually, on Thursday.
How does it feel when you come back to New York after spending a month in Africa?
To be honest, I feel a little overwhelmed when I walk down the consumer products aisle in a pharmacy, let's say, or a grocery store. And sometimes I guess I simplify my life. It's nice to be back because I realize by being in Rwanda, you really need your family, your friends, and a toothbrush, if that sometimes. Another thing that sticks out when I come back to New York City is actually how rich many countries we call developing countries are. And what I mean by that is the social fabric is so rich and the community is so rich. I come back to New York City, a place that I've lived now for about 5 years in total, and you'd think that I would jump right back into my community and go see five people the day I got off the airplane. But in fact, that's not necessarily the case because there is, even though proximity-wise we may be down the street from the person, there are just so many other things that people are involved in, and we have sometimes things that seem so pressing often catch our attention, and those pressing things may be the 1,000 emails in our inbox or you know, who knows? But in Rwanda, I think the contrast is the heavy rains for 2 days and the internet is out for 2 days, let alone if you have internet. Only 10% of the population is actually has electricity in Rwanda. So, you know, when I step off the airplane in Rwanda, I do see the five you know, five friends that day.
And the word pressing means two different things in both places.
Absolutely.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of SHE, Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses market-based approaches to address social problems. One of their first initiatives is helping to provide sanitary protection to menstruating women and girls in developing countries. Who helps to fund Sustainable Health Enterprises?
So we fund SHE through a number of different supporters. Our first supporter was and still is Echoing Green. And Echoing Green is a seed funder for social change organizations. And we were – it really – when I look back upon what sort of changed the game a bit, I have to say it was being awarded an Echoing Green Fellowship in May 2008. They were seed funders of Teacher America, SKS, which is a bank, microfinance bank in India. It was some financial support, but what's more, it was a great network of people. I have 20 other colleagues out of the thousands that were chosen to be fellows with me. And they are my confidants. And the last thing that Echoing Green brought to our organization is to be honest, a pat on the back and saying, you know, we don't think you're crazy. Your parents might think you're crazy, and your friends that are working here or there might think, oh gosh, when is she going to get a real quote real job?
Is that true? Do your parents and friends really think you're crazy?
They might, Jessica, but it has nothing to do with this enterprise. No. Prior to this, you asked different things that I was looking into. What really actually, more than anything else, was what piqued my interest was actually a job in helping commercialize the female condom. And so I got really excited about this because it was about health. It was about but also putting equality, putting the hands of sexual and reproductive health and in the hands of women as well, and commercializing it. But unfortunately, that didn't work out. But I did get wind of this, did catch to my parents, and so they weren't too surprised when I said, oh, by the way, our first initiative for SHE is sanitary pad franchising.
Because not too far from the female condom. Is that what you mean? Is that the connective tissue there? Or?
Well, I think the connected issue is around taboo. Taboo doesn't really make me shy.
Why do you think that is? That's striking to me. I find that I'm also somebody who just, you know, like frankly sees taboo as an opportunity.
Right.
but what are your thoughts about that?
I think taboo is definitely the thing linking the two. And I guess that's probably because I didn't necessarily fit in as a kid. I'm 6 feet tall. I was always one of the tallest people in my class. I played basketball probably better than most, definitely most of the boys. I wanted to play the trumpet in the band, which was quite loud. And if I didn't have braces, I probably would have. Also, I can't underestimate the confidence that my parents and family have given me. So I think I can have the confidence also because I've had the privilege of having a great education and support along the way. So I feel confident enough to address these taboos.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Elizabeth Scharf, founder of SHE, Sustainable Health Enterprises, an organization that uses market-based approaches to address social problems. Have you thought about maybe selling some of these pads that are produced in Rwanda by Banana Fibers in the U.S.? Have you thought about maybe creating an income for these women by selling their products internationally?
It's interesting. I think we'll definitely expand and look towards the East African community. And we'll also look to start up other enterprises in Central America as well as South Asia, where I get emails weekly from different places, like different areas that I've just described, saying, can we start up? Can you help us start up our own businesses here? Now, in terms of importing to the U.S., I'm not sure. Maybe if there's a clamoring of emails and calls right after the show, Jessica, we'll fire up the fire up the machines here. And,
well, at least there'll be a market in you and me.
Yes, that's true.
You mentioned Echoing Green as being an important pivot point for your organization. Were there any other inflection points or helpful allies that you've had in helping getting SHE or Sustainable Health Enterprises off the ground?
There have been a few other turning points for SHE, and one was just recently when we had hundreds of men join the SHE team and support us in a number of different ways, whether it be advisory or financially. And I think sometimes when I talk about menstruation or pads, actually typically the conversation has been about 20 minutes long, even with a complete female stranger. But typically the average length of time that a conversation about what I do with a man lasts about 20 seconds. And so we have, like I said, hundreds of new male advocates and allies on board. And they're so important because this is not, I don't want to belittle, say, just a women's issue, but this is everyone's issue.
How did you get so much support from all these men all of a sudden? Was there a specific catalyst?
Sure. Recently, there have been a couple of advocates such as Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times talked about our organization with a few others that are trying to bridge the gap between business and the typical charity model. The second is actually at the World Economic Forum. We were cited as one of a handful of examples of good sustainable design. So when you think about Davos, you don't really, in the World Economic Forum, you don't typically think of, let's just say, me and my friends. But we are happy that this conversation is happening in so many different places in the world, including the unlikely World Economic Forum.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
My guest has been Elizabeth Scharf, founder of Sustainable Health Enterprises. Coming up, we'll meet Simon Pierce, the glass blower and founder of the glass company Simon Pierce. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass, furniture, and pottery for the home. Simon is a hands-on craftsman who started selling his glass in rural Ireland in the 1960s. Even today, he generates his own electricity, builds his own furnaces, and makes all of his glass by hand. Simon Pierce has an international presence, including 12 retail stores in San Francisco and on the East Coast of the United States. Simon, can you please describe your business and tell me how your interest in glass originated?
Well, the emphasis on things to use on the table. And it all started, well, it started with pottery because my father was a potter and he made functional pottery. I did pottery for a number of years and then I switched to glass because nobody was making glass of the kind that I really liked, which had the same character as the pottery, which had a handmade feeling, like the early English rummers and the French rummers of 150 years ago. I used to buy them in junk shops for 50 cents in those days. They've now become sort of collector's pieces, and they're more expensive, but they had a very simple, a beautiful simplicity about them, a real feeling of handmade, which I really liked. And so that's how I got into the glass business.
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in County Cork in the southeast of Ireland. My father moved there when I was 4 years old. And contrary to what everyone believes, I'm not Irish. I actually have no Irish blood. My mother was Welsh and my father was English and I was born in London. But we moved there when I was four and Ireland's the country that feels like my home. My father was actually a very interesting man because his father started a printing works in London, but he really didn't want to live in London. And he discovered this little village. The story goes, he got the ferry to Cork and he had his bicycle with him and he rode it down 20 miles to this village called Shanagarry and stayed with some friends he'd been given the name of. And he was meant to stay for afternoon tea and he stayed for the rest of his life.
He seems to have had an adventurous spirit, just getting off the ferry and taking his bike and deciding he wanted to live there. Do you feel like you have some of that adventurous spirit in you?
Yeah, I probably have too much of it in me. It's interesting now you say that, where it comes from, but we definitely had that adventurous spirit. And I was very dyslexic, which nobody knew at that time in Ireland. And I really was never meant to be at school. It just didn't work. You know, school and I just didn't agree. And I'd keep running away and they'd keep sending me back. And it's actually an interesting story. I kept saying to my parents, I want to leave school. And they said, well, you can't leave school. You know, you have to go to school. And I kept doing, every summer I'd say, I want to leave school. And finally they said, okay. And I was 15 and, you know, I was halfway through high school. And I thought, wow, that was easy. You know, that's amazing. I hadn't really expected them to say yes, but they did. And I spent a year at home working in the pottery. And then I went off to New Zealand to learn to make pottery when I was 16. When I came home a few years later, when I was 21, I was sitting opposite my father at a dinner party. And I overheard him say to the person beside him, when Simon was expelled from school, and I had never known till that moment that I actually had been expelled. They hadn't just let me leave. They'd had to let me leave, but they'd never told me.
What a sign of your parents trying to instill a sense of confidence in their dyslexic son. They were followers of this educator named A.S. Neal, who advocated a form of education allowing your children to do anything they wanted. Can you explain that a little more?
He basically believed in the child and believed that the children who were having problems or in trouble just weren't really being helped find their path. And so in his school, you didn't have to go to school. You literally never had to go to a class at Summerhill. And he found that the kids, he really wanted to go to school, but if you forced them and if you made them, it didn't work. And they pretty much ran the school. They made all the rules. They decided, you know, how people should be punished or if they should and when. And it was a very extraordinary place.
And how did that manifest itself as a child? Are there any anecdotes that you can recall?
Yeah, my parents basically brought us up like that. We had an extraordinary level of freedom, always. They believed in letting the child find the limits. In other words, they never said, don't touch, don't do that, don't go there. There was virtually no don'ts. One day I wanted to go up to the chimney. And I was, I think, 8 years old. And it was quite a steep slate roof. My mother couldn't bear to watch me do this, but she couldn't stop me either. She didn't want to stop me. So she got in the car and left while I climbed out the skylight and climbed up onto the top of the roof and looked out, you know, over the bay or whatever I wanted to do and came down. But that was the degree to which they believed that we should find our own limits and barriers. To me, that seemed absolutely normal. And today, here in this country, you'd probably be arrested, you know,
child negligence.
Child negligence or something.
Have you translated that philosophy onto your own family?
I would say we had very much the same parenting skill. We did it the same way. I think we toned it down a bit, so our life as parents was not quite as crazy as my parents.
Or as miserable, perhaps?
Or as miserable. I mean, they had some tough times with us because it's not an easy philosophy to execute.
What I also found interesting about your parents was not only instilling the sense of self-confidence and adventure, but they also placed an emphasis on the products that you used in your home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was really what their sort of life centered around was, I think, beautiful objects and beautiful things. And music. My father he loved classical music and books because he had an antiquarian bookstore at one point. But they had this sort of philosophy that everything you used should be thought about. In other words, you didn't just buy something without taking some trouble to look at it and make sure that it was something you really wanted and really liked and that was really beautiful. And that didn't mean the things were expensive. I mean, I'm talking about things like egg cups, every little detail.
In a way, that whole emphasis portended or foreshadowed your interest in pottery and glass. Was it more through osmosis, or did you sort of have an epiphany moment where you said, I want to be a potter and a glass blower, and I want to make a business of this?
No, it was much more through osmosis. I always knew I'd do something with my hands. That I don't know why, but from a very early age, I knew that I would work with my hands. And I think at that age, I wanted to try something different and different than what my father had done. That was at that same time I started collecting that early glass that I liked so much. So that's how the two kind of came along.
My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass furniture and pottery for the home. How do you then turn this interest in glass into a business?
It was very hard to get into the business. I wrote to 15 companies in Europe, and most of them never applied, and the ones that did said no. Glass was just beginning in Europe in those days, studio glass. There was only one school in England called the Royal College of Art that had a glass department. And it turned out that a friend of ours was on the board of the Royal College, and she introduced me to the professor who ran it. And my belief had been if I was went to a college, you know, I'd never learn the skill. But it was the only option I had. And the professor at the time said he'd take me on for a year. And I was right. If I'd been there for 50 years, I never would have learned to blow glass. But it acted as a great stepping stone, you know, and I've always been very grateful to him for giving me that opportunity to at least get in somewhere. So then I went to the Rietveld Academy in Amsterdam. And then one of the professors there said, well, you should go down to Leerdam, which is a famous glass factory. And that's where I discovered the secret of getting into glass factories. You just go and you arrive and you talk to the foreman, not the top people who run it. That was where I got my first reel in. And I worked in that factory for 3 months with their master glassmaker as his assistant, just his gopher. And then I went down to Venice and got into a glass factory there called Venini, which is one of the famous Italian factories, and worked there for 3 months. And my job there was at about 6 in the morning when they started, I would go out to the local store and buy liters of white wine and liters of Coca-Cola and mix them 50-50. That's what they would drink from 6 o'clock in the morning until they staggered out of there at about 2 in the afternoon.
What is one called, that concoction?
Well, it doesn't have a name that I know of, but it was great for the thirst and it kept everyone happy. And they were the most skillful glassmakers I've ever seen anywhere. They were making the most incredibly elaborate pieces, unbelievable.
So how old were you during all this time? Were you in your teens?
I was about 19 when I was in doing that.
So then at what point do you say, okay, I'm ready, I have enough experience and expertise, I'm going to go back home to Ireland and open up my own shop?
Well, it had been 2 years since the time I started at the Royal College and I finished in Scandinavia. So it was 2 years. I got my inheritance from my father, which was $10,000. The Irish government gave me some help, and they had a small business loan, which I got from them. And so I put it all together and built this factory. This factory was a small workshop, really. I was interested in making functional glass, simple, beautiful, functional glass for everyday use. I wasn't interested in making art glass, one-of-a-kind pieces. But an interesting antidote, on my way back from Europe, I'd made a whole lot of samples of the sort of glass I wanted to make. And they were pretty basic and crude and so on, but I was very proud of them and I thought they were beautiful. And I went to London and I went to see the buyer at the General Trading Company and Liberty's, and I think it was Harrods was the other one, you know, and I proudly showed them my ware and said, you know, and they said, oh no, our customers would never be interested in something as basic or as crude as that, you know, that we'd never have a market for that. So that kind of deflated me a little bit. But anyway, I went back to Ireland and set up my workshop because I still believed, and I had enough friends who I knew were giving me honest feedback. The interesting thing about that is within 5 years, once I got going and we got a lot of publicity because I think that it was so unusual what we were doing in the very early days. All three stores came back looking for the product and never having realized that I had visited them or they had been turned me down. You know, there was that sort of disconnect. Once you've been written about and there's something, people think there's something special about what you're doing, then people change. It's amazing how that happened. But so I was trying to do, as everybody does when they start their first small business, everything. And I blew glass every day, but I'd be up all night with the furnaces trying to get the glass to melt. And I was also trying to run the business. You mean trying to get the orders and trying to sell the product and
how were you at the business? Because you had focused so much on the craft side of things. Did you like the business component, or did your father instill some sort of business acumen in you?
One of the things that I felt was really special about him was that he really enjoyed both parts of the business. He really enjoyed making pottery and all aspects of the making. And he also really enjoyed the business. He really enjoyed keeping his books, even though there was kind of one little ledger, but he really enjoyed that. And he really enjoyed dealing with the customers, and he really enjoyed selling the product. He had incredibly good business principles. Like, he was never late with an order. If you ordered something and he said you'll have it in 3 weeks, you had it in 3 weeks. And so I observed those growing up, and it was a great, great advantage, because I think many craftspeople would have a much easier life if they enjoyed the business side. But there's kind of this thing that we craftspeople can pick up, which is that the business is kind of a dirty word, you know. If you're into making things, beautiful things, then the business and making things don't really go together. But in fact, once you make something and sell it, you're in business. Whether you like it or not, you're in business.
Luckily, you did enjoy both sides, the craft and the business. How does your business then end up on the other side of the Atlantic in New England?
I was getting frustrated running the business in Ireland. There was a lot of things in those days that made it very difficult. And a lot of the basic services didn't work very well, like the phone and the post office and the taxes. So I just was getting very frustrated. It was after 10 years and the business was finally beginning to work financially. It took about 8 years for it to break even, and I decided to move to America.
And why did America appeal to you as a place to open up your business?
Because all my dealings with Americans, and we'd exported quite a bit of glass, and I say to small accounts, small amounts, but quite a few around the country, and all my dealings with Americans had been incredibly straightforward, and they did business, it seemed, the way I liked doing business, which was, you know, you just do what you say you're going to do and you get on with it. And I love New England. I love Vermont. And I loved the feeling of the country up there. And
were there things that were more difficult than you had expected initially?
Yes, there were. The only thing that was really threw me for a loop was the cost of doing business. And that was a real struggle. The things we didn't really have to do in Ireland, or didn't cost much if you did do them, like use lawyers and have insurance. All those sort of basic things that people use a lot of in this country and you have to use in business here, and health insurance and all those, we didn't have those.
And where did you set up shop in Vermont when you came?
We found this extraordinary woolen mill. It's an old brick woolen mill on a river in Vermont in a village called Queechy. And it's absolutely a spectacular sight. And the moment I saw it, I fell in love with it. I had a strong sense that Queechy would work, looking at the map and where it is in relationship to Boston and the major highways and all the tourists that come up for the summers and fall and so on. And it was just an extraordinarily beautiful sight.
It is. I've been. And what are your total sales?
Total sales are about $30 million.
And when you first came to the United States, which was when? In
71.
What were your sales once you got the mill off the ground?
I can't remember exactly, but I think we probably did about 100,000. You know, I can remember it took us about 5 years to break $1 million. And I thought that was, you know, the moon. I never in my wildest dreams thought we would do $1 million in sales. Well, no, not quite. It doesn't work like that. I always remember when the Irish Times wrote an article about me after we'd set up here, and they talked about the Irish millionaire. And I said, well, only in Ireland would they call somebody a millionaire who owes $1 million. It was a bit of everything. And it was that the retail store in Queechy was really the bedrock of the whole business. I wanted to make it a destination, almost an educational destination, where people could really come and see the product being made and use it, eat off it in the restaurant, drink out of it. So we had a glass making, we had the pottery, and we had the restaurant, and we had the retail store, where people could not only see it, but touch it. I always have a hard time with parents who tell their children not to touch the glass, because I love the children to touch the glass. And the children never break the glass. It's the parents who break all the glass. You know, they knock it off with their handbags or so on. But so
you should have a sign saying, children, please touch.
Yeah, we should have a sign saying that. because to me, it's, and that goes back to my mother and the education where, you know, the message you send to the child when you tell them not to touch, I think, is a really, really negative message, because you're really telling the child it's not smart enough to pick this glass up without breaking it. And I think that it's a very, very strong message if from the time the child is born until it's an adult, it's being told, no, you can't do this, you can't do that, because you're not smart enough to pick it up without breaking it, which is, so anyway, I shouldn't go off on my educational things.
Well, no, for those parents listening, I think they might want a lesson or two from Simon Pierce. Incidentally, you have a purple, it looks like a purple flower as your logo. What is that, that purple flower?
What that is, it's called a puntal mark. And when you make the glass and blow it, there's two ways to finish it. The way they used to finish it 100 years ago, which is you put a you attach it to another rod on the bottom, and you break the glass off the blowing iron, so it's now supported by this rod, which is called a puntal iron. It's a French word. And you heat up the rim in a little furnace called a glory hole, and you hand finish the rim. And that's how we finish most of our glass. And it also leaves this mark, which is our trademark, which is the puntal mark.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. It was a real pleasure to be with you.
My guest has been Simon Pierce, the founder of Simon Pierce, a company that makes handmade pottery and glass for the home. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions or comments about the show or about an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.